Okay. I hope everyone can hear me. If there's any comments or problems, let me know on the chat. So, welcome everyone to this new series, the new Thursday morning series called Fundamental Principles. And it's going to be based on a book, a great book called called Witness by Ariel Berger. It's lessons from Elie Wiesel. Lessons from the classroom of Elie Wiesel's classroom. I'll just show you what it looks like. Give me one second here and I'll show what the book looks like. Here we are. I'm sorry, I couldn't get the picture the right way up, but this is what the book looks like. It's a great book. It's recently been published. Now, this book, just to give you a bit of background, the author met Elie Wiesel when he was 15. He later became his student and then a lecture assistant, actually, and he was very close to him. And in his words, he writes, he says, "This book is based on 25 years worth of journal entries, 5 years of classroom notes and interviews with Elie Wiesel's students from all over the world." And he's been connecting with his students and getting their memories and lessons and so on and so forth. It's a fascinating collection. Just by the way, this has nothing to do with lecture, but just there's a beautiful sentence in this book that I wanted to show you. If you have a look on the screen, it says, Ariel Berger writes, "I was Elie Wiesel's student, and although he died in 2016, I still am." And that's a great thing about a student-teacher relationship, that a student is not just someone who gets knowledge from a person at a one-time event. A real student is something that lives with the student and continues to learn from them, even after the lesson is over, absorbs the lessons and the teachings and so on and so forth. The Talmud has a very interesting expression where one particular great sage of the Talmud said that after 40 years, I finally realized the depth of my teacher's wisdom. In other words, he'd learned the concept 40 years before, but it took him 40 years to understand it better, to go deeper, to appreciate it better, and to really fully absorb it. So I thought that was a beautiful little lesson. Now, I'm going to just explain what we're going to do in this particular series. Before I do that, just for those that are watching on Facebook, just the reason why it's a little bit an angle is normally I do Facebook Live on the same screen as I do the Zoom. It didn't work today, so I'm just doing it this way. So I'm looking back and forth. Now, in this book, what he does is he tackles a number of concepts. He actually has 7 concepts that he goes through. And what we're going to do over the next 7 weeks is each week go into another concept, explore them from a Jewish perspective, use Jewish ideas, even though many of the ideas are in the book, but I'm going to bring from, sort of extrapolate a bit and expand it a bit from the Talmud, from the Mishnah, from the Kabbalah, and so on and so forth. I'll just run through with you what the 7 concepts are. And they are memory, otherness, faith and doubt, madness and rebellion, activism, beyond words, and witness. Those are the 7 chapters. I'm going to go through each one today. Sorry, we're going to go each one each week. I'm in, and we'll do the first one today. Today we're going to do the concept of memory. Now, in the beginning of the chapter, of memory, the author recalls a class that Elie Wiesel was giving. Elie Wiesel, of course, you all know who Elie Wiesel is. He was just an amazing person, a war survivor, a person who rebuilt, and a person who really campaigned on reminding the world and training and ensuring that we should absorb values that are filled with tolerance and to do away with the hate that he experienced so much during the years of the war. So this particular chapter is called Memory. So at the beginning of the chapter, the author Ariel Berger recalls a class where someone asked Elie Wiesel a question, and I'm going to read it to you. He says, "Rachel, a doctoral student and a granddaughter of a Holocaust survivor, raises her hand and asks a question. Professor, what kept you going after the Holocaust? How did you not give up?" Professor Wiesel answers immediately, "Learning." That's the one word, learning. He says, "Before the war, I was studying a page of Talmud, and my studies were interrupted. After the war, when I arrived at the orphanage in France, my first request was for the same volume so that I can continue my studies from the same page, the same line, and the same spot where I had left off. Learning saved me. He goes on, maybe that is why I believe so deeply in education. If there is a solution to the problems humanity faces, education must play a central role in it. I know that learning saved me, and I believe it could save us. That was Elie Wiesel's response. Now, the author of the book says the following. He says, other students and Rachel seem satisfied by this response, but I find myself struggling. He writes, I am not so hopeful as our professor. Of course, I believe in education, but it is hard for me to see it as a panacea, a solution to the world's problems. Now, both the response of Elie Wiesel, before we go on, and this last piece where the author himself is struggling with the response, are both critical components to start with. Now, you know, it's interesting, we're now in the period between Pesach and Shavuot, and during this period, there's a custom to study Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers. In chapter 2 of the Ethics of the Fathers, there's an interesting teaching by one of the sages, and he says the following. He says, Ein bur yirei chet v'lo am ha'aretz chasid. A bur, an empty person, cannot be sin-fearing, God-fearing, nor can an ignoramus be pious. Okay. So, what does that mean? An ignoramus cannot be pious. Why? Because education is critical to being a moral, ethical, upright, and pious person. We need to learn, even if you are a good person, but you need to learn. A person needs to be educated to understand morality. A person needs to be educated to be stimulated and to develop a sense of purpose. A person needs to be educated to understand what is appropriate, what is the definition of good conduct. A person might be good naturally, but as they grow up, they might need to learn what actually good means, what moral means, to have a moral compass. So learning absolutely is the foundation of moral behavior. Interesting, the commentators in this particular passage in the Mishnah talk about what the difference between a bur and an am ha'aretz is, between a bur, an empty person, and a ignoramus. And they explain that a bur is someone who is ignorant, but also has a very rough personality. That person's in real trouble. They haven't learned, and their personality doesn't lend itself to goodness, to kindness, to morality, and so on and so forth. But an am ha'aretz, what the Mishnah, when it talks about ignoramus, is talking about someone who is good. Someone who's a moral person at heart, someone who wants to be kind, someone who wants to be compassionate, someone that wants to do the right thing all around, but hasn't learned, doesn't know how to extend themselves, doesn't know how to do more than just the letter of the law, doesn't know how to be really good in the true sense of the word, because education is such an important part of moral behavior, learning. I mean, in the Jewish context, we understand this better than anyone else. We are filled with learning. We are the people of the book. Education has been the cornerstone and the foundation of the Jewish experience for all times. So that's a little bit of insight before we go further and take it much deeper into Elie Wiesel's response. But the author's struggle with that response is also really, really important. Because what the author does after this, he says, actually goes on for a few pages about his own struggle. This is Ariel Berger. This is the student of Elie Wiesel. He talks about his own upbringing. I'm not going to go through the whole thing about the conflict that his parents had between themselves. One was more religious, one was less religious. One wanted him to go to this school, one wanted to that school. Anyway, he went to a Jewish school for elementary school. And then when he graduated into high school, his father wanted him to go to a secular school. His mother wanted him to go to an extremely religious school. The compromise was he went to sort of what they call a modern Orthodox school. And whatever the case was, that's not relevant. The details are not that relevant. But he writes that when he went into high school, he was bothered because he says the traditional texts were the same ones we studied in first school, but the connections between text and life seem frayed. Now, this is not an indication of all schools and so on. Just this is his experience. He says, judging by how my classmates treated one another, many of them clearly hadn't internalized the teachings and no one corrected the students' behavior. So he said they were studying, but it didn't seem to affect them. Now, in truth, and I'm just going to bring back the screen here, because in truth, this is a very, very clearly laid out in the Talmud. in this piece that I have here on the screen. And the Talmud talks about the Torah and how great Torah learning is. But the Talmud says an interesting thing. I'm just going to try and say it clearly, especially for those who don't have the screen on Facebook. That zacha, if a person merits, the Torah is like a potion, says the Talmud. And if a person merits, then the Torah can be a potion of life. Lo zacha, if a person does not merit, it becomes samha mavet. The very same Torah can be poisonous, can be fatal. Amazing thing. There's so many pages and pages in the Talmud and in the commentaries about the greatness of learning Torah, about the greatness of connecting to Torah, about the importance of absorbing knowledge of Torah. And yet the Talmud says that if you don't learn it in the right way, if you merit, if you have a zechut, it'll be a potion of life. But lo zacha, if you haven't merited, the very same learning can be counterproductive. The very same learning can in fact be a potion of death. Poisonous, fatal. That's quite astounding. Now we're going to come back later to the exact expression here of zacha and share with you something much deeper than that. But the concept is true. The concept is true that it's not enough to learn. It's not enough to study and to learn values. We need to give voice to those values, as the expression goes nowadays. We need to be able to bring the values to life. We have to apply them to ourselves. We have to live them. How do we do that? Obviously, education itself isn't enough. And as the author is writing this, he recalls that after he had the struggle with Elie Wiesel's response that the fact that education is this key to survival, he realized, he says, that Elie Wiesel himself, in his writings and other places and other lectures, he struggled the same way. And he has a beautiful piece in the book called The Betrayal of Knowledge. And I'm going to read to you a little bit some of this part, and it's just beautiful. He said that Elie Wiesel had a passion for learning, and it did indeed save him by breaking his isolation after the war and providing meaning, and even more important, the quest for meaning. But the gap between humanity's supposed wisdom and the world he lived in troubled him. He said he had many painful questions to ask, but the one that drove him to become a teacher was this: why didn't the learning and knowledge inoculate the German people against hatred? After all, it was one of the most advanced nations on earth. And then he brings a beautiful thing that Elie Wiesel himself wrote, and he quotes, and he says, Elie Wiesel writes, and he says, one of the darkest days of my life after the war, when I discovered that many of the killers, the high-ranking Nazi officials, the front-line murderers alike, had advanced university degrees. Many were students and scholars of Goethe and Kant, those great thinkers who explored the concepts of ethics and moralities. And he says, I always believed that education was a shield, that to be educated means you cannot do certain things. How come this is not correct? So when that student asked Elie Wiesel in the classroom, what was the key to survival? He said, education. But then he himself struggled with the same question his student struggled with. Is that true? Is education enough? And therefore, in response to that question, Wiesel sought to create a new kind of learning. And that new kind of learning was actually not new at all. I mean, it's new in the terms of the context of the modern world, and it was framed as something new, and Elie Wiesel put it in such a most beautiful way. But the truth is, it's the cornerstone and the fundamental of what the Talmud tells us of how you can learn and merit, and how you can learn and not merit. And it depends, all depends how we learn. And he says that there had to be a hidden element, one that could fulfill education's promise to protect against moral and ethical corruption. And he said he looked for the element, and eventually Elie Wiesel described that element of learning that would ensure that learning would in fact be a protection for moral behavior, and he called it memory. And memory, of course, is the name of this chapter. Now we have to explore and develop what actually he means by this and how that all comes about, and bear with me because we're going to go through it and hopefully at the end understand what he meant by that concept of memory and its link to education and the element of memory and what that means in terms of learning, what that means in terms of education. But you know, I want to just go back and give a bit of context, right? Because this idea of learning, but then making sure that the learning is applied and the learning is internalized and the learning becomes relevant to our moral and ethical and appropriate and spiritual behavior. This is really the essence of, I mentioned before, this concept, this custom that we have between Pesach and Shavuot to study Pirkei Avot. Now, I want to just talk about this for a moment. Pirkei Avot is a collection, or what we call, it's a part of the Mishnah. Now, normally, in fact, I had this discussion with someone a few weeks ago. I suggested to someone who unfortunately lost a loved one, and I said, you know, you can't say Kaddish now because we don't have a minyan, there's no shuls, and so on and so forth. And I suggested to them that they learn Mishnah. But I knew that maybe the Mishnah was a bit complicated for them, so I said, you know, study Pirkei Avot, there's an English translation in most Siddurim, and so on. And I got a call from a relative. He says, what do you mean? Pirkei Avot is a Mishnah? Now, what was his question? Because when you say the term Mishnah, Mishnah normally means a collection of law, right? All the laws of the Torah, Shabbat and the festivals, laws of damages, laws of court cases, civil laws, marriage laws, all these laws are all explained in the Mishnah. That's what Mishnah is. It's a collection of laws. With the one exception, the tractate, the collection, the five chapters, the six chapters of Mishnah, of Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot is very different. Pirkei Avot is not laws. Pirkei Avot is about ethical behavior. It's about social interaction. It's about appropriate behavior. It's about how to go extend yourself beyond the letter of the law and be a good person and interact with other people in a good way and how to be a spiritual person. A completely different style to the rest of the Mishnah. And strangely enough, the very beginning, the very first Mishnah of Pirkei Avot starts the following. It says, Moshe kibel Torah misinai. Moses got the Torah from Sinai, and then it goes on to explain to us how the transmission and the chain of Torah worked. It went to the elders and to the prophets, and then the Tanaik and the sages of the Mishnah, and so on and so forth. And the commentaries asked, why doesn't it put that at the very beginning of the Mishnah with all the laws? Why is this passage right at the beginning of Pirkei Avot? What's it got to do with this content of Pirkei Avot to know the transmission of Torah? And the answer is so critical, because Mishnah Pirkei Avot is teaching us that ethical behavior, moral behavior, how we become good people is linked inseparably from the concept of Torah study. You need to understand that the ethical behavior, the midot, the good qualities, the personality strengths that Pirkei Avot demands and expects and encourages us to engage in is part of Torah Misinai, because they cannot be separated. If you learn the rest of the Mishnah without applying it to good behavior, which is explained in Pirkei Avot, you haven't really learnt. You haven't merited. Because it's Torah, it's theoretical, it's law, but it hasn't been applied to making you. Of course, the laws are there to observe and the laws are there to keep and for so many different reasons and connection to God and so on and so forth, but they need to come together with that ethical, moral, good behavior that Pirkei Avot tells us, Moshe kibel Torah misinai. It is embedded, it is part of what Torah was all about. And Torah was all about is that it needed to be applied, it needed to be put into practice, it needed to make you a better person, it needs to improve you. You know, this is a very painful topic, but I'll share it with you anyways. You know, at Bina, we as you know, we run a department, which is about, not, by the way, which is back in action now if you need to contact the office. We run a department of checking mezuzot and tefillin. And I've had a very unfortunate reality of people bringing in new tefillin or new mezuzot that they bought in Israel. After all, if you buy something in Israel, it must be good, right? And they bought it from a shopkeeper that looked very religious, had a beard, looked like he was knowledgeable, was surrounded by Hebrew books, Judaica books. And you open it up and it's a fraud. It's not kosher. It wasn't written kosher. It's terrible. And it's painful. How could such a thing happen? And it's more painful when people ask me. Now, I'm a big supporter of religious observance. Don't get me wrong. I would encourage people to keep Shabbat, to eat kosher, and so on and so forth. And then they turn around to me and they say, how could a religious person do this? And my answer always is, your question is wrong. He's not a religious person. A person cannot be religious if you fraud someone, if you're unethical. If you're immoral, you cannot. That's not called religious. He might know something, he might have learned, but he puts into the category of lo zacha. He hasn't merited. He's learned, but he hasn't applied anything. He hasn't improved himself. Now, that doesn't mean that if you just be a good person, that you don't need the Torah. We need that. That's for a different discussion. But Torah must change the person. Part of Torah learning, all learning, must change the person. And in Elie Wiesel's context, he called that concept memory, and we're going to see why in a moment. So, Elie Wiesel liked to tell stories, apparently, from Reb Nachman of Breslov. You have to bear in mind that Elie Wiesel, before the war, grew up in a very, very religious Hasidic family, which belonged to the sect of Hasidim called the Vizhnitsa Hasidim. He remained very close after the war to many, many Vizhnitsa Hasidim and Vizhnitsa Rebbes. He continued his Torah study. He had a very close connection with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He very, very was much still very involved in that world, although he took a bit of a different path, but he taught a lot of these concepts which he was so steeped in. And one of the things he did, he liked to tell stories of Nachman of Breslov. Nachman of Breslov is famous for his parables, for his stories, and they all have mystical meanings. And one story he tells is the following. It's a really cute story, and he says like this. He says, once an astrologer king, a king who was an astrologer, saw in the stars that anyone who would eat of the coming harvest would go mad. He called in his viceroy, his second in command, and his friend, and he said to him, what's your advice? This is like really serious. Sir, he replied, the counselor, you and I shall eat only last year's harvest, which is untainted, and so we will remain sane. But the king replied, no, he says, I do not accept your proposal. How can we separate ourselves from our people to remain the only sane people among a nation of madmen? They will think we are the ones who are mad. Instead, you or I shall eat the tainted grain, and we shall enter into madness with our people. Then the king thought for a moment, and then he said, however, we must at least recognize that we're mad. We have to recognize our disease. Therefore, he says, you and I shall mark each other's foreheads with a sign, and every time we look at one another, we will remember that we are mad. Now, this is a cute story, and we'll see what the application to this whole discussion is. But before I do that, I must just tell you an interesting little thing. That when he told that story, in his classroom, there was a debate. And that debate has to do with leadership. And one student said, if the world is mad, we need leaders who are not mad. And therefore, the king was right, the counselor was right, to say that they shouldn't eat the meat, the wheat. And the other one says, no, how can you be a leader and stay separate from your people? And therefore, they were correct in saying, no, they should eat the wheat and become mad with everyone else. Which highlights a really fascinating discussion about leadership. And it's all about, a leader has to be somewhat separate from the people he's leading. Otherwise, what's he giving them? You can't just be part of their world, because if he's part of their world, what new thing is the leader introducing? On the other hand, the leader must be involved and engaged in the world of the people that he's leading or she's leading, because otherwise he or she has no connection and cannot relate to them. So that's a fascinating discussion in its own right. But let's go more. So in the discussion, Elie Wiesel says in this classroom, and this is what the author is describing, he says, What was Rav Nachman trying to get at? He says, maybe Rav Nachman, and this is something that maybe is validated by some of Rav Nachman's writings, and he says, did he anticipate, he lived a few hundred years ago, did he anticipate that the world is going to have a lot of madness in the next couple of centuries? Right? Did he realize that things were going to happen that could be determined as real madness? And he therefore, he says, it makes sense that he would interpret the sign on the king's forehead of his friend referring to memory. In other words, when we see something, when we experience something, when we become part of a madness, when we become part of something that is different to the normal, we need just not to notice it, but we need to understand it and remember it and acknowledge what it is and how it relates to us. The king put a sign on his friend's forehead to say, me and you will look at each other and we will remember and acknowledge that we are mad. Meaning we will remember and acknowledge that we are living in a world that is mad. And that's part of what he meant in terms of memory. Let's develop this a little bit. Let me just digress for a moment and share with you something. So in the Torah, we have a lot of mitzvot that are to do with memory. For example, one of them has to do with what we just did. We had just observed Pesach in the last number of weeks. And in the Torah, there's a verse, V'zacharta, you shall remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and therefore treat other people, it's in context of treating people that are unfortunate or less privileged. Remember, you also once slaved, right? We have a Seder where we sit down and we experience freedom, but the Torah and the Haggadah tells us with great emphasis that you have to experience the Seder. You have to not just remember it, you have to experience it. We have another mitzvah in the Torah that talks about remembering Amalek. What does it mean, remember Amalek? It's a whole thing. Every year we're supposed to read the passage that remembers what Amalek did to us. Now, I mean, if you study, you'll know. What do you mean you remember? What's this emphasis on remembering? Every Shabbat, we're supposed to make Kiddush. How do we know Kiddush from? Where does Kiddush come from? Kiddush comes from a verse in the Torah that says, Zachoret Yom HaShabbat. Remember the Shabbat, right? What does that mean? What it means is because memory does not mean, the word memory, and this is where the depth of this whole concept is, the word memory doesn't only mean retention of knowledge. That just means to revise, to retain knowledge. We call that memory. We say, oh, he has a good memory. He remembers all the sources, he remembers the material, he remembers for the exam, he passed, whatever the case is, he has a fantastic memory. We talk about people with a photographic memory. That's not what we mean when we talk about memory in this discussion. In this discussion, memory is a whole different thing. In this discussion, memory means making it relevant. Memory means learning something and making it part of your experience, making it part of you, internalizing it, right? To put it a different way that we've explained once before, we have three parts of knowledge called Chochmah, Bina, and Daat. Chochmah is the conception of a new idea. Bina is the understanding and the building of the process to fully understand it. Daat means to internalize it. Why do we sometimes learn something and understand it so well, and we can lecture on it, we can share the idea, but it hasn't become part of our experience? And if it hasn't become part of our experience, it won't change us. And we won't remember to apply it, and we won't take it later and apply it to our experience and apply it to our way of living. We won't internalize its values because we don't really remember it. Meaning we might remember the knowledge, might be able to repeat and parrot the concepts, but we don't fully internalize it. We haven't memorized it. Memorize it means we haven't made it part of who we are. It hasn't become part of our experience. When we sit down to the Seder on Pesach night, God tells us, I don't want you to tell the story. I don't want you to remember history. I don't want you just to tell a story that happened to your forefathers so many years ago. I want you to experience, I want you to make that knowledge part of your experience as if you are leaving Egypt. I want you to apply it so you are becoming a different person. You are becoming free. You are applying the principles. You are going beyond yourself. You are living by those values of what freedom from Mitzrayim represents. When you make Kiddush on Friday night, I don't want you just to remember this concept called Shabbat. I want you to experience Shabbat. Zachor, remember the Shabbat. Make it part of who you are. Make it part of your experience. You know, make it personal. I once heard from someone, they told me a story about his Zayde, about his grandfather, who was an old Hasidic Jew, a real humble person, and he was a kind of allergic to arrogance. He was allergic to people who were arrogant and egocentric, and he admired, he emphasized the concept of humility. And this old Hasidic Jew was once in hospital. When he was in hospital, he was visited. Someone was going around the hospital doing a nice thing and visiting. And he saw this Jew in bed. He came in to say hello and he introduced himself. And then he wanted to impress this guy in hospital. He wanted to impress this rabbi. This story really works better in Yiddish. So I'll say it in Yiddish and I'll repeat it in English as well. But so he says to him with an air of arrogance. He says, you know I am. Ich hab gelernt ganz Shas. I learned the whole of the Talmud. That's who I am. And this old Hasidic Jew lying in bed is. So he said, can I ask you a question? And I'll say it in Yiddish because it works much better, but I'll translate it. He said to him, Du hast gelernt ganz Shas, aber das Shas dir gelernt? You learned the whole of the Talmud, but did the Talmud teach you? Now in Yiddish, Lernen and lernt is the same word. Teach and learn is the same word. So it's like saying you've learned the whole Shas, but did the Shas learn you? In other words, did the Talmud learn you? Did the Talmud teach you? You might have mastered intellectually the whole of the Talmud, but did the Talmud master you? Did the Talmud become part of you? Did the Talmud change you? Did your learning really change you? Did your learning make you a better person, that you're learning, what you're learning internalized, that it strengthens your values, that it inspires you to live differently, to make every day a different one than the day before, and to become a better person, inspiring yourself and inspiring others. Now, I want to go back. How this works is the following. I want to go back to that thing I told you before. I want to share with you just a beautiful idea. Remember we said that when a person learns, the Talmud says that Zacha, if he merits, it becomes a potion of life. Lo Zacha, if he didn't merit, it becomes poison. So let me tell you one of the Kabbalistic commentaries of this passage. The word Zacha, which I've just highlighted so you can see it there. The word Zacha means to merit. But it has a different interpretation. Lezachech in Hebrew means to become refined. To refine. This is the secret. Zacha, a person who learns. If a person is refined, if they're prepared to absorb something beyond them, if they're prepared to internalize the teachings which wasn't part of their experience before, they're prepared to make it part of themselves, they're prepared to be a refined individual, then the Torah will become a potion of life. Your learning will be beneficial. Your learning will protect you. Your learning will protect and preserve morality and good living and appropriate living and ethical living. And it'll make you a person who's truly God-fearing, a person who's truly moral, a person who's truly spiritual. But lo zacha, if you're not refined, in other words, if you learn, but you remain trapped in your own prison, you remain unrefined, you remain stuck in who you are, you remain not willing to learn, and it's just a theoretical concept that you, because you love to learn, so you're learning knowledge and you're absorbing concepts, but you haven't really absorbed it, you haven't learned from it, it hasn't taught you, you haven't put aside your ego, you haven't refined yourself so that you will be able to absorb something that maybe you didn't understand before, that maybe you'll understand appropriateness or inappropriateness, good and evil, morality and immorality in ways perhaps you didn't understand before, so that you could work on yourself and you can go beyond your comfort zone and you can go beyond your personality and you can work on your personality. Lo zacha, if you didn't become refined, some of it becomes a poison. And that's the essence of what Elie Wiesel was explaining, that concept, memory. You need to learn to memorize. You need to learn with true memory. True memory means that it becomes part of your experience, it becomes part of who you are. You let it into you. You don't just master the concept, you let the concept teach you. You let the concept infiltrate you. That's such an important thing. You know, he brings that in 1939, Hitler, may his memory be blotted, Yimach Shamoy, gave a speech to the Wehrmacht commanders. And it's reported that he said, he brings this in the book, he says, "Who remembers the Armenians?" And what he was referring to, of course, was the Armenian genocide, which began in 1915 and is apparently considered by the historians to be the first modern genocide. And why did he ask that question? Because he asked it in a cynical way. That his remark, Hitler's remark, was meant to reassure his co-conspirators that their horrific actions would not be censured. The world would not protest a new genocide, which is unfortunately and tragically exactly what happened to a large extent. Moral amnesia, he writes, is an invitation to murder. What Hitler was saying, Hitler understood this. He said, "Who remembers the Armenians?" Meaning, don't worry, it's in the history books. Everyone knows about it, but no one's remembered it. No one has internalized it. No one has taken a story, such a tragic story, such an evil story, and said, "Well, what does it mean to me? Does that mean the philosophy I learned, therefore, has to change me and I have to be a better person? And I have to understand tolerance and I have to understand kindness and compassion?" Don't worry, no one remembers it. It's fine. You're safe. That's the opposite of memory. And he continues to tell a different story, a beautiful story, to emphasize this point, that when we learn something, we need to make it personal. That's what it means. Internalizing something we learn, really remembering something we learn and applying to ourselves makes it personal. Make it part of our experience. Make us part of the story. And he tells it, again, another sort of little favorite story from Hasidic tradition. And he says the following, I'm going to read it because it's written so beautifully. He says, "Once there was a man who was so forgetful that when he awoke in the morning, he didn't know what to do with strange objects he found in his room. Every morning saw him painstakingly trying to determine what each item of clothing was for, looking them up in research books and finally putting them on correctly. It took him hours and he was always late for work. One day, he decided to label everything in his house. He did so, And the next morning when he awoke, he looked around, following the label's instructions. He dressed quickly. He recognized the chair from the note that sat on it quickly. He saw the note on his socks and put them on his feet quickly. Then as he was leaving, his eye fell on the mirror by the door. He looked in the mirror and froze. Bewildered, he whispered, "But who am I?" He says it's not enough to know the facts. We must take things, history, current events, personally. We must look in the mirrors. A great literature, a great body of study can be a good mirror. That's what memory means. Memory means to look in the mirror. Memory says, I'm learning something. I have the chokhmah, I have the binah, but I need the daat. Learning means, that's why we study Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot is teaching us that the foundation is, how's it going to change you? So that when you go on to learn everything else, you go on to learn the laws of Shabbat, the laws of damages, the laws of this, the laws of that. It's not an academic study. It's not learning legal studies. It's learning something that's going to change you because you're going to make it part of your experience. When you learn the history of Pesach, it's going to be your experience. When you learn that we learn about Shabbat, it's going to be your experience. You learn about a kindness, you learn about a story, or you learn about evil things in history. It's going to become your experience because you're going to internalize it and make it so personal that you will learn from it, not to emulate those stories, even in the slightest, even in the most subtle way. Because sometimes we learn evil stories, you know, that's actually part of the problem. Sometimes we learn about real evil stories and atrocities. We learn them and we become horrified, but we say, oh, we're not even remotely connected to such evil. And we need to understand, great evil doesn't start with great evil. It starts with subtle evil. And we all have subtle problems. We all have subtle weaknesses. So any story we learn, doesn't matter how evil it is and how atrocious it is, memory, we have to look in the mirror. How do I fit into the story? Where am I in this experience? Not just the labels of all the facts that I know, but where am I? How am I making this personal? How am I making it part of my experience? You know, I want to just, this wasn't the intention of the series, but I want to just stop a moment, pause for a moment, and talk about what's going on now. Because, you know, I've heard a few people have told me this comment. You know, we're going through such a bizarre time. If I would have asked anyone a few months ago and described the period we're going through now, you think I'm a Meshuggah, right? And I've heard the expression, people are saying, you know, in a few years, what we're going through now is going to be part of the history books. And that's true. It is true. But it's also tragic to say that. Why? You know, there's a lot of terrible things going on now, a lot of unsettledness, a lot of anxiety, a lot of pain, unfortunately overseas, a lot of death, a lot of sickness, and so on. There's also a lot of good things that have happened. And I've heard this from lots and lots of people. I've spoken, thank God, to lots of people over the last few weeks. And so many of them have just shared with me their struggle. But so many of them also shared with me how they're dealing with it. And amazingly. And the common theme that is coming through is that people are having a re-look at their values. I think we're focusing on what family means, either because we're missing people that we can't see, or we're spending more time with the people that we should have spent more time with before, and now we are. We're spending more time with our children at home. We're spending more time learning and studying. We're spending more time with a less of a focus on material pleasure, material gain, because we can't go out, we can't party. So we've sort of realized we've had a lot of us, and many, many, many of you, if not all of you, I'm sure, have had a bit of a rethink on purpose, a rethink about meaning, a rethink about what our priorities are. And we're all doing that. And that's a fantastic silver lining about what is happening now. It's amazing. But here's the question we have to each ask ourselves now. Memory. Is this going to just become a piece of history? When this is all over, please God, soon? Are we just going back to normal? Are we going to just slip back into normal life with all our strengths, but all our weaknesses as well? Or is us and the world going to learn something? Are we going to take it with us? Are we going to take it with us into normal living? Are we going to take perhaps the things we've been doing now? Are we going to spend more time when we don't have to? Are we going to spend more time with our family? Are we going to remember to wake up every day and be grateful for the things that we do have? Are we going to do that when we go back to normal? Are we going to make this a personal experience? Or is it tragically just going to become history, which our children and our grandchildren, I know it's going to be funny when we, you know, when we, many, many, many years from now, we'll tell our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, stories about 2020, about what kind of crazy world it was. I mean, we'll, and it'll be funny. But the question we have to ask ourselves is, did we look in the mirror? Is it us? Are we personally in the story? Are we personally being affected? Are we all being affected now? But are we going to be affected later? Are we going to remember? remember, not just remember the facts. Are we going to remember how it changed us? Are we going to internalize it? Are we going to make it part of who we are? Are we going to actually become a changed person and hopefully a changed world? I fear that there's a danger that it won't be like that if we don't really work at it. So let's not just learn now. Let's just not think. Let's just not reflect on our value system. Let's plan to how we plan to put this in practice when we go back to the office. Let's plan to how we put this back into practice when we become busy. Let's plan how we put this back into practice when we have to put on birthday parties and events and so on. Do they have to be so outrageous? Do they have to be? Let's just think about our value system. Let's think about how we don't have to prove anything to anyone, have to be ourselves. Let's think about how we move more inwards now and take it with us, make it a personal story. Do what Elie Wiesel calls memory, so that we'll be better people afterwards. We'll phone people that we didn't phone before. We'll connect to people like we're doing now. We'll try and be kinder, more tolerant, and more accepting. And we'll try and enhance our relationships like we're trying to do now. But when we go back to normal, let's become a changed person. And let's remember in the sense of making it our own experience. And let me just end with one beautiful thing that he says. Because he says that when he talked about this whole thing, and of course in Elie Wiesel's context, he was talking about experiences of the war and his survival and his own experiences and the evil that he witnessed and wanted to communicate to the world so the world should remember. So a student asked him a question. How can we students with comfortable lives really understand your experience, much less pass them on to others? And that's a great question, because something you experience, there's a hope you can remember. But how do we really remember something that belongs to a different world? How do we personalize something? Or can we personalize something? Obviously, the Torah says we can, but that's why we have to remember the going out of Egypt, which happened over 3,000 years ago. But how do we do it? How do we actually really internalize something that's from so far away? So I just want to end with this beautiful, beautiful story that Elie Wiesel told. Again, a Hasidic story. He says, and I don't know if this is, you know, they say about, I'll just share this with you. There's so many stories about the Baal Shem Tov that they say it's, statistically, they cannot always be true. So I once heard, when I was growing up, they used to say like this, the Baal Shem Tov was a real tzaddik, and he could do wonderful things and miraculous things. But does that mean all the stories told about him are true? Probably not. And they used to say that if you believe all the stories of the Baal Shem Tov, you're a fool. But if you don't believe them, you're a heretic. What that meant was that they didn't all happen, but they could have happened. In other words, the Baal Shem Tov was the Baal Shem Tov. So I'm not sure if the story happened, but it's a beautiful story. So he says, when Rabbi Israel Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, saw that the Jewish people were threatened by tragedy, he would go to a particular place in the forest where he would light a fire, recite a particular prayer, and the miracle was accomplished, averting the tragedy. Later, when the Baal Shem Tov's disciple, the Maggid of Mizrich, had to intervene with heaven for the same reason, he went to the same place in the forest. And he turned to God and he said the following. He said, I don't know how to light the fire, but I could still recite the prayer. And again, the miracle was accomplished. Later, he says, when the Rebbe of the Moshe Leib of Sassov was a disciple of the Maggid of Mizrich, he went to the forest to save his people. He said, I do not know how to light the fire, and I do not know the prayer, but I can find the place, and this has got to be enough. Once again, the miracle happened. And then he says, when it came to Rabbi Yisrael of Rizhin, the great-grandson of the Maggid of Mizrich, who was named after the Baal Shem Tov, and when he had to avert the threat, he sat in his armchair, holding his head in his hands, and he said to God, I am unable to light the fire. I do not know the prayer, and I cannot even find the place in the forest. All I can do is tell the story, and it must be enough, and it was enough. In other words, it's beautiful, a beautiful insight. There are many things that we're experiencing now, and I hope we'll make them personal and we'll learn from it. But there are things that we have to learn from previous generations. There are things we have to learn from yesteryear, from generations ago. We live now in a frightening world when it comes to the Holocaust, talking about Elie Wiesel, where Holocaust denial is on the rise. It's absolutely crazy, even from a factual point of view. So we have to tell the story, but we have to tell the story of the Holocaust. We have to tell the story of generations gone by. We have to tell the story of Pesach. We have to tell all the stories. We have to learn history, but tell the story is enough, and it must be enough, and it will be enough as long as we personalize it. As long as when we learn, it is part of our experience. We become part of the story. Whenever we tell a story, We need to become part of the story. So in summary, education is the core. Education must be critically part of morality and moral behavior and appropriate behavior and good living. Education is the key. Part of education is telling stories, learning facts, understanding concepts, processing ideas. But it will only be the protector of moral and good living if we apply memory. The memory means to be refined, to let it into our experience, to make what we learn part of who we are. Whenever we learn something, let us ask the question, what does this have to do with me? How am I part of the story? If it's a positive thing, how do I apply it? If it's a negative thing, how do I make sure I stay away from it? But either way, I've got to be part of the story. And when I'm part of the story, then the education is complete. And education is complete, it protects and improves and enhances good and appropriate living. So I hope everyone followed that. It's a little bit difficult because I don't see people's feedback. But I'll unmute you all now and have a wonderful, wonderful day. And pleasure. And just have a wonderful day and let's take all these lessons. And next week we'll continue with the next lesson, the next part of the chapter. You're welcome. And hi there, Javi. All the best. All the best.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye bye. All the best. Bye.